This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 13th of April, 1957. The title of this lecture is Radiation in War. It is Radiation in Your Survival, tape number 6. Copyright 1957 by L. Ron Hubbard in the United Kingdom. Copyright 1978 by L. Ron Hubbard in the USA. All rights reserved. Unauthorized translation, duplication, importation, and distribution is a violation of applicable laws. This tape is 61 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Thank you very much. This next lecture here is Radiation in War. You thought I covered that, didn't you? No, not even vaguely, I'm afraid. Not even vaguely. That was radiation in peace. And we have here, although I didn't tell him I was going to speak, Harold Stassen has just rushed up to the United Nations to suggest that all future fissionable material should be used exclusively for peaceful purposes. There's a great deal of pressure on the governments of the world, to damp out all this radiation and not to use it. Various groups throughout the world, whatever country they're in, are suffering from this pressure. But that is not what causes this type of statement, which you have seen sporadically from time to time. Russia makes a statement that we ought to be very peaceful about all this, and the United States makes a statement we should be peaceful about all this, and any other nation that had this should have some inclination to do that. But these organizations are under pressure. And in this radiation and war, I think I can show you why they are willing to listen. It's not just this sort of news which follows through, which is more important than Mr. Stassen's statement. I am sure that President Eisenhower at any time, if he could with conscience feel that he was protecting the United States, would, of course, abolish testing and all the rest of it. But he feels that he must protect the country. And he feels that he has a weapon here which is capable of doing that, and he feels he should follow through. But such governments as United States and Russia are pressured consistently, much closer to home than some church group or some group such as our own or some other group, as though we have ever pressured the government, which we have not. And that was just below this other story, and it says scientists won't make H-bombs. 18 top German scientists, led by 78-year-old Otto Hahn, a pioneer of nuclear fission, today told Chancellor Adenauer, "We refuse to take any part whatsoever in making, testing, or firing atomic weapons." They tried that revolt in 1945 and failed in the United States, but in other countries that revolt is continuing. It is very difficult to find a nuclear physicist today who will stand in and read the meters, who will do the mathematical computations or anything else. These men are men too. They have families, and they know very well that their own children, their wives, and themselves could be made extremely ill, and that the civilization which they have been brought up to cherish is likely to disappear before any atom is ever used in war. Just the testing of it alone could bring about such a condition. And this is undesirable to them as to us and any other citizen anywhere in the world. But what is a government up against? Why doesn't a government at once say, well, it's an undesirable weapon, we'll just dispense with it? Why doesn't it say that? Well, modern governments have gone very deeply into the world of science in order to execute their battles. At one time, they depended exclusively upon the courage and some minor weapon of its infantry, the man. They depended on him to go in and bring a better state of compliance on the part of some neighbor or enemy nation. They no longer depend on that man. They have already developed weapons that are much more important to them than the courage of infantry. These weapons have already been used in World War II, so we are not talking about fictitious weapons. Every bit of scientific lore which can be accumulated by scientists in the hope that it may better the lot of their fellow men eventually is employed in their destruction. This is a rather hideous commentary on the practices of man, and begins long before we ordinarily think of its having begun. In 1870, the fellow who issues, you've heard of Hotchkiss guns? Hotchkiss, I think that was the date, desired to end war by developing a weapon so violent that no one would dare fight war. And he developed the Hotchkiss gun. And it has been used in every war since. He wanted to end war, so he developed a weapon. You've heard of the Nobel Peace Prizes? Well, TNT and dynamite was invented to make war so horrible that man would not fight it. And we see a reflection of that aim in the Nobel Peace Prizes. But nevertheless, this man invented something that laid in ruins European cities and London in World War II. Interesting, isn't it? He wanted no more war, so through threat and fear and duress, he thought to drive men into an opinion that war could no longer be fought. And this has always been the case. Hire a big enough army. Arm it well enough. Teach your enemy that it is sufficiently ferocious, and you will not have war. But every time, it has brought war. Evidently, it is not a good method of controlling other nations, since it has never worked. Man should observe that this has never worked. And someday, perhaps even now, he will. Today is using scientific weapons. You know very well the scientific necessities which lie back of an airplane, which lie back of TNT bombs, which lie in back of anti-aircraft, which have 2,000 separate connections per weapon. The most intricate thing you ever saw is one of these radar shell anti-aircraft weapons. Quite deadly. They throw ammunition up into the vicinity of an aircraft, and as it explodes, it is certain by aircraft radar that the plane is in its center. This is all worked out scientifically, called proximity shells. That was what knocked off kamikazes. That's what made it possible for battleships to ply the waters on the very shores of Japan during the end days of World War II. This is no classified information. Everybody knows about these proximity shells by now. But that's a very intricate scientific weapon. But how much further has man gone? Well, he developed in 1927 or 28 a political weapon called brainwashing. A chap by the name of Pavlov, who had been experimenting with the reactions and conditioning of dogs, was brought to the Kremlin by Stalin and was put in a separate room and was asked to write everything he knew concerning the conditioning and actions of animals as it might apply to the human being. And he wrote a 400-page manuscript, which since that date has never left the Kremlin. Immediately after that, in 1928, we saw the astonishing factor of cabinet ministers, cabinet level, Russian officials confessing to the most outrageous crimes. They walked up before the bar of justice and at their own trials condemned themselves glibly. And that was the first the world saw of brainwashing. In the Korean War, less expert people used these same techniques on the troops who were employed in the Korean War. Now, brainwashing is child's play. No one should be very worried about brainwashing. 20-some percent of the soldiers who are captured in battle will crack up in prison camps. And brainwashing does not violate this percentage. It is not anything to be afraid of at all. It is a rather flimsy thing, because the people who invented it, the man who invented it, and the people who have used it, are not sufficiently acquainted with the mind in order to make it effective. An inspection of brainwashing cases demonstrates that brainwashing here and there worked. Brainwashing is a very, very simple mechanism. There's hardly anything to brainwashing. You get a fellow to agree that something might be that way, and then drive him by introverting him and self-criticism to the possibility that it is that way, and then the fact occurs that that was the truth. And by a gradient scale of pounding and hammering and torture, they are able then to make people believe that they saw and did things which never occurred and which they never did. And that is brainwashing. But it's just minor. Its effectiveness is minor. They did not know enough about the human mind, fortunately. Nevertheless, Pavlov himself, directing the use of his original manuscript, was certainly effective on these top Russian officials back in 28, those treason trials that shocked the world. These men had never done anything that they said they had done. They had simply been conditioned into believing they had done it. Now, brainwashing was attempted on Mindzhensky. Very interesting, it didn't work. But for a moment, he quivered and wavered at his trial. That's the only thing it did. Then he didn't stick by it. And brainwashing is not an effective weapon, but it could be worked on, developed, and with the information about the mind denied to the rest of the human race and kept secret, brainwashing could be made to be effective. And if that happened, then society could be made into slaves. Therefore, anything that is known about the mind or could benefit the mind must be permitted to exist in public view. It must be possible for anyone to lay his hands on how to undo such things as brainwashing. Therefore, there must not ever be a restriction of technologies concerning the human mind. These must never become buried. There must never be a hierarchy in some university that dictates the only thing that may be used and that invalidates all of the abilities of people who can work in the field of the mind. There must not be such a group. That would be a very, very dangerous thing to have happen to the race. Why? Because we have this thing, brainwashing. It is not effective and it's not dangerous, but it could be. Every Scientologist can undo brainwashing. How do you undo brainwashing? You simply bring the fellow to present time. He's stuck on the back track. He is thrust into the past. He is introverted. All you have to do is extrovert him. Let him see where he is, how he is, and what he's doing, really. And brainwashing desensitizes. But it's not even a problem to us. But it's a problem to the governments of the world. Now, they say, this is very interesting. You know, if I go into the next war, and I throw a great many troops into this war, and the enemy grabs hold of these troops and puts them in prison camps as he captures them, and then works upon them so as to disarrange and derange and change their loyalties, and then sends them back into my country as saboteurs, provocateurs. This could be a dreadful and terrible thing. And it worries them. Why? Because governments depend on loyalty. And the fact that it might be possible to change the loyalties of individuals worries these governments. Now, any Scientologist with a knee meter could tell whether or not somebody's loyalty has been changed. That is not even a problem. But it is a problem to the governments. And they are working in their own way, trying to solve that problem. They're not making much progress. You see, the government itself is threatened by the weapon called brainwashing. All right, we have the head of state. He appoints some secret police. The secret police one night grab hold of the head of state. They brainwash him. How can we ensure then his cabinet ministers that as he sits there at the head of the table, he is not dictating the policy of some foreign nation? That's dangerous stuff. The fact is, it could exist. It could happen. And there is one weapon which is no good. It is not a good weapon. It is not proven useful. It is simply dangerous. And it's something that worries people. And that is a modern scientific weapon. And its future history can only be dismal. Because the only thing it can do is shake the foundations of the governments which employ it. Russia must have various organizations posting guards every night around Bogan and Khrushchev to make sure that nobody slips in and brainwashes them. You see how upsetting this is? This is a very nervous thing. How can we continue to guarantee their loyalty to Russia? Well, you see, they could become very upset about this thing. Now, you and I are in association, let us say, with some business partner or a marital partner, and all of a sudden this person starts to look a little bit wobbly. We know something is wrong. We question the person. We find out that the person is in rather poor mental condition. What do? We do the efficient thing. We give her an intensive. But they don't have this technology that we have. And so they worry themselves silly. Because if anybody brainwashed the head of state in Russia, one, nobody has the skill to detect the fact. And two, nobody has the ability or the technology to undo it. That's a pretty dreadful weapon then, isn't it? Even though it's not terribly effective, even though it only works once in a while, that becomes a dreadful thing to have around kicking inside of a government. All right. The only reason I'm talking to you about brainwashing is not because we're very interested in brainwashing. It's not even dangerous as a subject. You could take a company of troops and train them up, and the possibility of their ever being brainwashed thereafter would be laughable. The Scientologists merely take them and group process them for a while, and they'd never get brainwashed. It takes a very unsettled, unstable, neurotic personality to succumb to brainwashing. He has to be mad already, because Pavlov never found out how to drive a man mad. He merely found out how to utilize incipient madness. All right. I'm only talking to you about brainwashing because I want you to see that governments have problems. How about you say radiation is not this sort of thing. A government uses radiation against the populations of other countries or against its own. Now, therefore, radiation could not be this kind of a problem. Oh, yes, it is. Radiation is a much more deadly threat to centralized government than it ever is to a population. And that's an adventurous statement to make. But Russia will rue the day she ever dabbled in brainwashing, and she is certainly going to live to rue the day that she dabbled in atomic fission as a war weapon. How is this? One has to understand something in the history of war. That's a very dull subject. Very dull subject. Big, thick tomes have been written on war. So you don't mind if I capsulize it, you know, and make it very short, swift, painless, and brief. The history of war is the history of control. The end goal of war is to throw out of its control the population of another government. Now, this is just a little bit more advanced than the last definition of war, which was about 1792, which was a rather lengthier thing to compel some compliance and obedience on the part of the other government. That is not really what war is supposed to do. War is supposed to throw another nation's population out of control so that you can then supplant that government or its attitudes and give them their population back into control again. In other words, you levy a war in these modern times against a population on the theory that it will fall away from the controlling government, and the controlling government will collapse, and this can then be changed. Now, Alexander the Great did this much more rapidly. Whenever he went up against an enemy ruler, he took his companion cavalry, rode through the ranks, found the enemy ruler, and cut him to pieces. This was his idea of tactics and strategy. He's been criticized as a strategist. That's because he didn't mess around with populations. He just went and annihilated the other government. Every time he was confronted with a government, he killed it. Darius, for example. He wasn't against the government or even the household of the ruler. He never even attacked the household of the rulers he killed. He generally married their wives. He did in the case of Darius. Now, he was very direct. He knocked this person out of control of the government very directly by knocking him off. But modern war philosophy is a little bit different. You hammer and pound the population one way or the other until it can no longer be controlled. And they figure then the government will blow up. Well, that's more or less the theory on which they work. And so they use weapons which are anti-population weapons. They don't use a short sword at the throat of Kaiser Bill. They use machine guns thrown at the troops of Kaiser Bill. You see? And they overrun the villages and towns and so forth. And more modernly, they bomb the living daylights out of the factories and cities of Kaiser Bill so as to make the population give up. Population can no longer continue, therefore the government can no longer continue. In other words, the population is out of control, smashed flat, and there it goes. Now, what would be an ideal weapon to do this? I'm afraid it's a rather sinful answer. Tested radiation. If you kept testing radiation, other populaces would get nervous, wouldn't they? And they'd say, can't we have peace somehow or another? So you see, in the face of a radiation-impregnated atmosphere, you really have a different attitude here. And a government which doesn't have radiation is apt to get a bit worried about governments that do have radiation, you see? Because there is an effect being rendered against the population which they themselves cannot halt. There's no defense against radiation, remember that. So you have actually the end goal of war being executed in times of peace simply by saber rattling. But this is, again, a philosophy which is very old. You took a large armed force and you paraded it. And everybody said, oh, we don't want anything to do with that. Let's have peace with those people. We couldn't get any enthusiasm on the part of the populace toward fighting. But this is a more sweeping thing, in that it is not localized against another government. And we have then encountered an unlimited weapon without direction. since atomic testing is as deadly against one's own population as it is against the population of another nation. And we get to problem number one of the atom bomb politically, and it's not a good thing for a government to have, because it'll throw their own population out of control, too. Throws everybody out of control. Now, it's an historical fact that the history of weapons has brought up several which were unlimited, against which there was no defense. A weapon for which or against which there is no defense becomes an unlimited weapon. And when these have appeared on the stage of man, governments have collapsed. Formal government cannot exist in the presence of an unlimited weapon. Now, this is a very factual, down-to-earth statement, and it's something that appears in the textbooks of strategy and tactics. When you have a weapon against which there's no defense, governments become extinct. There is a period which is covered almost by legend between 1500 B.C., and 1200 B.C., where an unlimited weapon swept out of the steppes of Russia and smashed any civilization which existed in Europe. It smashed us so thoroughly that we haven't any records really of any kind. First thing that we come across having anything to do with this is the poems of Homer. And they used to be considered very legendary, and people have now gotten around and found there was really a Troy. And they said, well, he was writing about a real fight. That was history then, put in a poetic form. Before the days of Troy, this period occurred, the horse and the sword was the unlimited weapon, and it swept out of the steppes across Europe, just as it did in 1200 and 1300 A.D., that many thousands of years later. This early period found the nation without defense against a cavalryman. Infantry could not stand against him. He was mounted, he was swift. His saber or sword penetrated any existing armor. And with or without formation or plan, he could overrun any city. Nothing in that city could stop him. You could put up infantry, but he just mowed them down. It wasn't until recent times that they finally put a pike in alternate files and so stopped cavalry from charging and wiping up infantry. Napoleonic times. Very recent development. Nothing like that stood against these cavalrymen as they came in from Russia. Nothing. And they carried everything before them. And there was nothing like an organized government throughout the length and breadth of the Mediterranean or Europe for 200 years. And so we say, well, nothing existed in that period. That is not true. Things did exist in that period. We don't have much record of them, however. And then somebody got a defense for it. Then somebody invented a defense for it, and once more governments could exist because a defense existed against the man mounted on a horse with his sword. And that invention was the wall. That seems like an elementary invention. But it certainly stopped this inrush of cavalry. And men could build a wall around their cities, could enclose their populaces and protect them against these expeditions which had rendered everything chaotic throughout Europe. Not even its own government on the steppes that originally sent those men survived their use. That government, too, has been swallowed up. It's gone, with no record left. It's a fascinating chapter of history, but there's very little known about it. I know of two or three books in English which mention this period, describe it, and sum up their evidences concerning it. Unlimited weapon, no government possible. Why? Because no city could be possible. Nobody could sit down anywhere and govern from anywhere. The moment that you sat down and started governing and your communication lines started coming in, you started collecting taxes, all of a sudden some irresponsible guerrilla band, not even any longer part of the regular army of the enemy, would sweep down and wipe you out. No police was possible. There was no policing of roads. Nothing. Not even a man on a horse with a sword could fight a man on a horse with a sword. These tactics were not developed for centuries afterwards. Any military man can tell you something about this. The only point I'm making is there's an unlimited weapon. And what does it do to a government? It kills it. There is a weapon against which there's no defense. And what does it do to a government? It makes government impossible. You want to know why people are worried about this atom bomb? And why they would like to get together and say, no more atom bomb, please? It's because their own governments are in danger from its existence.